Namaste and welcome to another edition of the Bharat Varta Weekly. I'm Roshan Karyapa. I'm joined by Abhishek Paul and Nirav Kanudra to bring you through the news and events of the week that was. It's been an amazing week. India has made it to the World Cup finals. Of course, I'm talking about cricket here. We also have a bunch of geopolitical stuff. There's a reshuffle in the UK and an ongoing political crisis, if you can call that. Then on to the US, we'll bring you updates from Chinese President Xi Jinping's visit. Of course, he's met President Biden, he's met Governor Newsom and others there, including the business leaders. And closer home, RBI has decided to crack down on personal unsecured loans, and that is impacting a bunch of businesses. We'll also bring you a few other news items. The demise of Sahara Group's Mr. Subroto Roy. Of course, I mean, he was in public memory about 15, 20 years back for not the right reasons. The Chhattisgarh MP elections have been ongoing. And this morning, tech Twitter woke up to the shocking news of Sam Altman, the OpenAI CEO, being fired. All of this and more on this Bharat Varta Weekly. If this is your first time, don't forget to follow or subscribe to us on your favorite platform. We publish episodes on politics, policy, and culture. And yeah, if you like that content, you could stay updated on this channel. All right, Abhishek and Nirav, plenty to discuss. But first of all, we've made it to the finals of the Cricket World Cup. So it's going to be a repeat of the 2003 World Cup. Well, hopefully with different results this time, right? India and Australia both face off against each other. Of course, India cruised through the group stage, finishing top on a maximum 18 points, having won all of the 9 matches that we played. And Australia, on the other hand, was in a precarious position earlier, and they bounced back after defeats to India and South Africa in their opening matches, won their remaining 7 matches. Well, I would say both teams have momentum, kind of evenly matched, but obviously India is looking invincible at this point of time, right? I mean, I hope I don't jinx that. But yeah, Abhishek, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the two best teams overall eventually reached the final. The good thing was, I think, both the semi-finals were quite exciting in their own way. Like, they were very different matches, but proved to be quite exciting. I think Indian fans definitely were feeling jittery when Kane Williamson and Daryl Mitchell were having a very good partnership, right? Because we have not faced much adversity in this tournament, so you kind of get a little scared early when you face one. So yeah, I think it's good that the team did face some adversity in the semi-final. But yeah, I think Australia are a very strong team. I would say rate their batting to be stronger than their bowling, simply because they have a lot of hitting power. People like Travis Head, David Warner, Mitchell Marsh and Glenn Maxwell, they've all scored heavily at various times in the tournament, and they are type of players who, like, in an hour can, you know, win you the game if they are, it's their day. So I think I would say it's a 50-50 match. India do have the advantage of the home crowd, right? 130,000 packed in the stadium tomorrow, but Australia have the sort of edge in big matches, right? They invariably tend to perform well in these competitions and are, like, very good in finals and knockout matches and stuff. So yeah, I think hopefully I would hope it's more of a repeat of the 2011 quarter final, which was in the same ground, rather than the 2003 final.
Yeah, yeah. Let's all hope it's a 2011 repeat and not a 2003 repeat, as I inadvertently kind of said that. I only say that because the same teams are playing. Hopefully different results this time. You know, any of us have nightmares from that still, right? I saw this very interesting segment by Jared Kimber on YouTube on, you know, how can you beat India? And it's a very sort of a rhetorical question. And he says ultimately that, you know, you cannot beat India in this shape and form, because we have the the batsmen and the bowlers who are like top class and in form at this point of time, right? And this is something that we saw even in the semi-finals, where arguably, I mean, we're pushed to the ropes, you know, Williamson batting very well. And, you know, Kuldeep comes and bowls in those two or three overs and sort of contains them, and it becomes a Herculean task for them to score, right? Nirav, what is the Achilles' heel if there is for India?
Okay, so I'll tell you what has happened is India has won all 9 games, and like few of the games have been like very one-sided. The first 10 overs, we've had a great start apart from the match versus Australia, right? So I think in case the openers don't do well, how does the middle order react? That can be like a question mark. Second is, we've got like 5 good bowlers. Worry is if what if somebody gets injured, because our so hopefully fingers crossed no one actually gets injured, because Australia, the weak link is their 5th bowler. It is like part-timers like Travis Head, Glenn Maxwell, Mitchell Marsh will be covering 10 overs. So that can be a problem for them. So I think the first 10 overs for both sides, I think that is crucial. You see the game versus South Africa. I think rest of the game was all very, very even. It was the first 10 overs of South Africa's batting, which Australia dominated, and the first 10 overs of Australia batting, where they ran away with the game and were kind of ahead and stayed ahead through and through. And then despite South Africa pulling it back a bit, it wasn't enough. So I think those are crucial points. There's a lot of distraction. There's an air show. There's a mid-game show. There is something at the end, closing ceremony. It's they're trying to make it like the Super Bowl in the US. I'm not a big fan of all these distractions. I don't know how the players feel. All I want is India to win the World Cup. I was fortunate enough. I went for the semis in Mumbai in Wankhede Stadium. Lucky we won. I'm not going to Ahmedabad. But yeah, supporting the team through and through. Indian team also has happened. So what has happened is Australia won the first game was versus India, second South Africa. They've lost the first two. Then they've slowly built up. And then they face South Africa again in the semis, and they're facing India again. So it's like kind of a mirror image. So now can they pull it back, or is this Indian team like the Australian team of 2003 and 2007, where they won all the games bossing over everyone else? And I think hopefully Indian team is like that. It reminds you of the Australian team in 2003. India lost the first game to Australia, then was close, like a very close game versus Netherlands. They scraped through, but then they built up and then they lost against Australia in the final. So I hope it's like reversed, and Australia, their first game and the last game both end up in losses versus India. So yeah, fingers crossed. Hopefully, I think if we go through the first 10 overs, also like some of the middle order or lower middle order batting hasn't been tested. Surya Kumar Yadav or Jadeja haven't had, well, the team is doing well. They haven't had that much opportunity to bat. But hopefully everyone delivers, and yeah, we win. I think man for man, India is a better team. The conditions also favor India. And if we had like a best of 3 finals, I would say surely India wins it. But on one day, who knows? So yeah, fingers crossed.
Yeah, yeah. Would you change things up in the side? I mean, maybe bring in Ravi Ashwin or something, or stick with the winning combo?
I think stick to the winning combo. Ravi Ashwin, had it been like a very square turning track, maybe, but not as like the pitches have played out so far. So stick to the winning combo and go through it. Yeah, I'm an Ashwin fan, but I think in this scheme of the things, in this team, probably Kuldeep Yadav deserves... or Jadeja deserves a spot ahead of Ashwin at this point.
All right, all 3 of us have called it for India. By the time you guys are listening to this episode or watching this, I mean, you guys have already seen the results. Be kind to us. I mean, we're only guessing on half information here. But yeah, let's hope that India has made it through. All right, moving on. There is high drama in the UK with yet another cabinet reshuffle in the midst of an ongoing political crisis in the country. Last week, Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister of Britain, sacked his Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, after her criticism of the police for the handling of pro-Palestine protests. She was immediately replaced by the Foreign Secretary, James Cleverly, which also led to the surprising comeback of the former Prime Minister David Cameron as the new Foreign Secretary. These moves are said to be a positive for India, as the harshest critic of an FTA between the two countries, Suella Braverman, is out of the way, and David Cameron, who is who has good relations with us, is again back in the cabinet. Nirav, what does this mean for India?
So what does it mean first for the UK? Like, what has happened is UK is a kind of deeply divided society on the whole Israel versus Hamas issue. I wouldn't call it Israel versus Palestine. It's Israel versus Hamas. And Suella Braverman has said, you could say it's threading a fine line politically, because if you see politically, there are very few Jews compared to the Muslim population. And maybe I think their voting behavior could be probably one way or another. But I would say Labour has a lot more immigrant votes and a lot more Muslim votes, or who are more pro-Palestine. So she made a comment the police was lenient on those protesters, all those protests for Palestine, and compared it to the police being stricter on other demonstrations, or there is the whole World War One victory march which people were taking part in. So that got a lot of backlash, and right now due to multiple reasons, the Conservative Party is trailing behind Labour in polls. Though they are in power, they're trailing behind massive. So I think Rishi Sunak probably did some damage control. So he's gotten Braverman out, and he's gotten in James Cleverly from the Foreign Secretary, made him the Home Secretary. So in India's terms, it's the Foreign Minister versus the Home Minister. And David Cameron, who was kind of in retirement, brought him back as Foreign Secretary. There are a few others as well, a few other cabinet reshuffles as well, between the Department of Roads and the Environment and Health and Social Care, etc., and for pensions. But I would say those are relatively minor. I think this is the big one. And India-UK FTA is being stalled. I was hoping it would be signed by Diwali, and I have been wrong. There are a few sticking points, but I don't think either Braverman, who's of Indian origin, or Cleverly, probably I don't think they disagree too much on those issues. So for India, it doesn't change that much. Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, previous Prime Minister, very experienced politician. He had a meeting with S. Jaishankar, so that is great. During Diwali, Dr. Jaishankar was in London. He met Rishi Sunak and family, and he also met David Cameron. So hopefully, there's a little more cooperation on that front. It's not just the FTA. There are a lot of other things where India wants to be aligned with the UK, and UK wants to be aligned with India. So I think, and India needs to be very cognizant of the fact that next year we have elections in India, and later in next year or early in 2025, there'll be elections in the UK. And we want to get a lot of these things signed, because in case the government changes anywhere, we'll be starting from scratch. So that is what it is. I think the whole sacking of Suella Braverman has not been probably, I would say, on competence at the job, but it's more of a political consideration. And I think politicians are very well aware, and they are very keen on winning the next election. And it's a fair call by Rishi Sunak and his advisors. Only time will say how it actually plays out electorally, or whether anyways they're going to lose, and whether this makes any change or no. And it's a good comeback for David Cameron. So into public life. So he was a prime minister. He took a referendum on Brexit, which kind of backfired, to silence the other right wing, like UKIP and BNP, British Nationalist Party, and UK Independence Party. But yeah, I think he's come back after time out away from public eye. So that's great. I think, you need an experienced team. You need a good team. And hopefully delivers well for the UK. For India, hopefully the cooperation is enhanced. I don't think there's a major change either ways, but hopefully it continues a strong cooperation with the UK.
It's a pretty interesting situation in UK politics, right? Where even the Conservative Party has to sort of woo the Muslim vote, because I think they're a significant voter base, right? So, and I don't know, I mean, the police, how is it governed, right? I mean, who sort of controls the police? Abhishek, Nirav, if you can, talk about this.
So the police, because it's a small country, think of it as one state in India, right? So the police does come under the Home Secretary. And yeah, so
But
it's
they are supposed to be independent. So it's like they are officially under the Home Secretary, but they are supposed to be independent. And the thing is that I think in countries like UK, US, like unions are a big thing, right? And over time, the police has become quite, let's say, left-wing in these countries, right? The composition of the police force, the behavior of the unions and their preferences, policies. But in some ways, I mean, if you just look at the scenes there, you could say simply that they were outnumbered, right? Like even if they would want to do something, they are in no position to, you know, control those mobs or make those arrests on the spot. I would say some of the most interesting tweets have been from the Metropolitan Police, UK Police's accounts. If you see, like, they are giving their pronouncements on what is acceptable speech and not, like some intellectual, right? Like the police is taking those calls, right? So they are, for example, I don't know if it was in the US or UK, right? Because there are all these protests, but one of them said, you know, that there is no law in which, you know, we could have arrested these people, although they are sort of whatever, defacing some monument, etc. And then there are obviously Twitter users giving them section of law and all that, right? To explain to the police, you know, which laws are already there. So quite interesting stuff happening there.
All right, let's move on to the US now. In late October, California Governor Gavin Newsom, in a surprising move, met Chinese Premier Xi Jinping in person in China. He was the first US governor in several years to visit China after Governor Brown in 2017. Xi Jinping later attended the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in San Francisco earlier this month and also met US President Joe Biden. Despite not achieving a joint statement or formal cooperation declaration, the summit is said to have ended on a positive note. Biden expressed optimism about the real progress made in the talks. This progress, however, is likely to be short-lived as President Biden immediately went on to call Xi Jinping a dictator in a public press conference to the dismay of a visibly uncomfortable State Secretary, Mr. Anthony Blinken. Yeah, I mean, did you see that video of, you know, State Secretary Blinken, you know, wincing as Xi Jinping, I mean, as, you know, President Biden called Xi Jinping a dictator?
Yeah, I mean, that was very amusing. So
yeah, hilarious.
The thing with Joe Biden is you don't know whether what he wants, what he's saying is what he meant to say or he just happened to say it because he's old now.
You don't know if he's taken his medication or how much of it he has taken at any moment of time, right? I mean, yeah, that's sad to say that, but it's a very unpredictable sort of a situation.
Correct. Like, he's also unpredictable in his own way.
Yeah. So seems like, I mean, at least on that, you know, him and Trump are overlapping, right? I mean, if not on the policy front. But yeah, what do you guys think about this? You know, I mean, is it like a very superficial thing? Or does it also reflect the fact that, you know, China, given some of its domestic problems, is starting to make amends globally, right? I mean, Abhishek.
So, I think one thing was that when Nancy Pelosi, who was the then speaker, visited Taiwan in August last year, the US and China had ended up severing any military contacts, right? So that seems to have now been decided that they will restart military to military contacts, which is, in a way, it's good because you don't want another war right now, right? So, and then a presidential hotline is supposed to be opened now. And then the US has asked or got China to sort of agree to curbing fentanyl production, which is probably a big issue facing US society. So, yeah, I think there have been some sort of progress in terms of the two countries again beginning to talk to each other in some meaningful way. But I think US business is still probably keen to, continue with China. I think before the call we were talking, right? So Neeraj said like decoupling is probably not possible, but de-risking is the extent to which the countries can do with China. And that is obviously continuing throughout the world. On the Taiwan issue, obviously, tensions will continue to remain high. I think time and again, Chinese statements seem to suggest that, it could be any time, right, when they decide to sort of move in formally. And I mean, a lot of analysis around the world seems to suggest that the US is in a pretty bad shape if actually there is a hot war right now with Ukraine, Russia ongoing, the Middle East crisis. So three fronts might be a bit beyond the US's capacity. But one more interesting thing from this visit was how Newsom decided to clean up San Francisco, right? Otherwise, it would have been too embarrassing, right? Given how we have seen all the pictures, and maybe Carrie, you have visited SFO recently, but things are pretty bad there. So, as someone, I think Noah Smith said, it's more like a choice that people have, right? Like if people want, these cities can be cleaned up in a day, right? It's because there's no shortage of money in San Francisco, whatever it may be, right? So, yeah, that was interesting to see.
So Balaji Srinivasan had written a very interesting piece, Only Newsom Goes to China or something of that sort, right? Where he argued that, Newsom is one of the smarter Democrats and he is allying with China to be able to like consolidate power in some sense, right? So yeah, fantastic piece. I mean, you guys should definitely check that out. Yeah, this whole cleanup of San Francisco was a bit, I mean, I don't want to use the term, but sort of like third worldish, right? I mean, that
Yeah,
they were
like
able to
what
clean up
we are
everything.
accused of doing
Exactly.
for a G20 or whatever, like US doing the same is tells us like they are probably closer to us than how it appears.
And the fentanyl production as well. I mean, we've seen that it's a major crisis in the US with the, I think it's the leading cause of deaths among youth in the US at this point of time, fentanyl overdose, right? And so what China has agreed to is stopping the export of precursors to fentanyl. So there's some 50 or 60 products that go into fentanyl, which is being exported to Mexico and the US, right? So they've decided to stop that. Nirav, this whole, Taiwan, the One China policy and so on, right? I mean, do you think the US will just play along? Because I don't think it really costs much to say that, yeah, I mean, we agree with the One China policy and then, simultaneously support Taiwan as well, right? I mean, that
See,
strategic ambiguity of sorts.
yes, so yeah, their official policy is strategic ambiguity. I think probably they don't want to be drawn into a war, but probably they want Taiwan to buy arms from them. So that is also good. See, this is like US and USSR, the way they were like having talks, having all of those things. Plus, there's a lot of trade between the two countries. A lot of American corporations have a lot of exposure. A lot of people have factories sourcing things, all your iPhones. India is on track to make like 7% of iPhones. And I think Vietnam is going to make some small percentage of iPads and MacBooks, right? So I think they all are very enmeshed together. So that is there. So they want to like, it's like, you can call it like a frenemy situation and competing in some places, cooperating in some places. And let's see what it does. The whole thing, the fentanyl thing, I think China was on the other side of the opium trade, which UK actually kept selling opium to China, and you had a lot of youth addicted to it, and that kind of brought the downfall of the last Chinese Qin dynasty. And so I think this one where US is asking China to clamp down maybe shows like the power equation probably has changed a bit, or the ball is in China's court. But let's see whether the actual action is taken or no, or is there just some like cosmetic cover-ups done there. We will see. I think both sides kind of need each other. Without buying things from China, the inflation would skyrocket in the US. And without US buying Chinese goods, the Chinese economy will collapse a bit. So I think both need each other. And so they are like competing in some areas. They're cooperating in some areas. And it is a bit like USA versus USSR. So yeah, let's see how it plays out. I think this will take again like a few decades to see the effects of like this specific meeting and like future meetings going ahead. Also, that China had gifted some pandas which they've taken back from the zoos. Now they're going to gift another set of pandas. So the panda diplomacy is there. So yeah, let's see.
Amazing. The summit also led to a key agreement restoring military-to-military communications. I think that is a crucial thing. It de-risks any miscommunication, so to speak. And of course, I mean, the hot topic always, right? AI regulation and so on. I mean, there was some talk about that as well. Well, all right, closer home. After repeated warnings, the Reserve Bank of India has swooped down on banks and NBFCs. Their growing exposure to unsecured credit in particular. The Reserve Bank has increased risk weights on consumer credit to 125% from 100%, making such loans expensive. The decision excludes housing, education, vehicle loans, and loans secured by gold or gold jewelry from the higher risk weight. This move comes as the RBI's response to a rising trend in unsecured loans that could be a systemic risk for financial institutions. Nirav, is this, something to worry about or, it's a fairly par for the course?
So, see, this is RBI is being a bit proactive as a regulator. So, basically, what is the addition in risk weight? So, banks have to have minimum capital adequacy about 8%. So basically the value of the stock. So you take the value of all the assets that the bank holds minus all the value of the deposits, liabilities, or like debt which the bank has borrowed. That should be about 8%. Or so most banks are usually higher than that, closer to 10% or more. And similarly, NBFCs have a lighter touch regulation and NBFCs don't take like retail deposits. So the consumer growth, unsecured lending are the fastest growing piece in India, maybe showing some signs of overheating. I think people are quite optimistic. People believe that they have the ability to repay the debt. They have expectations that their income is going to continue increasing. And yes, Indian economy right now is in a bright spot. But what if there's a global recession or something? So India also might be hit. And most people are optimistic when they take on a loan. Nobody wants to default. But if their circumstances change, probably they might in the future. So what RBI has done is, so, for example, for every 100 rupees of consumer loans that a bank would give out, they need to have at least 8 rupees of equity capital. That has gone from 8 to 10. So now a bank's board will have some targets that I need so much return on equity. So either they can say, okay, I lend less to consumer businesses and I lend more to housing loans or auto loans or business loans or like infrastructure loans, etc. Right? So that is one possibility that you see less growth. So I think it'll continue growing, but at a slower pace. Or consumer loans are still profitable. People are not yet defaulting. Everything is fine. But now if I need to hold more equity against it, then I need to be charging a little bit more. So maybe like a 50, 60 basis points higher interest rate will be there on these loans. Versus to adjust for the risk or adjust for the regulatory cost. And I think we'll see somewhere a mixed bit of both. Again, who does it affect? Consumers who are borrowing unsecured, yes, it makes borrowing a little bit more expensive for them. And maybe the whole approval process might get a little bit tighter. For especially NBFCs and fintech lenders who are focused a lot more on consumer lending, it affects them a bit more. And for large banks, like big retail commercial banks, they have like a lot of, they have different sets of loans. They lend a lot to like large companies, corporate loans, housing loans, so infrastructure loans, government debt, security, etc. So for them, this is a small percentage. And then they might choose that, where do I want to grow my balance sheet a little bit more? And so, yeah, I think it's very prudential approach by RBI, it is not changing anything. See, it's not saying that don't lend. It is not, it's just saying that the credit growth year on year had been about 20%, whereas nominal GDP is growing at about 11 to 12%. So you take the GDP growth plus inflation, so about 7% GDP growth, about 5% inflation, so or 4.8, etc. So we are growing at 11 to 12% is the whole economy is growing. But the borrowing, consumer growing growth debt is growing at 20% year on year. So it tells you that this is a initial sign of overheating. So you're going too fast. You just gently apply the brakes or downshift gears a bit. But this is continuing to grow. And yeah, hopefully, I think this is a very smart way of regulating all these financial entities, ensuring that when there's a crisis, what would happen is you'd see a little defaults and NPAs increase. Then these banks might have to be recapitalized. So then they will have to either, then for the PSU banks, who is the lender of last resort, or it's the government will have to recapitalize these banks, right?
Right.
So I think it's a sensible decision.
You think it'll impact the spending? Because, I mean, I understand, you know, some of these card stocks and stuff were trading, you know, 4-5% below their levels, right? So do you think that that will have an impact?
Yes. So at the margin, if I would just like to ask someone, you are buying a consumer electronics item, you're buying a new phone, would an interest rate of 12 versus 12.5% change your decision? Probably not. Think about it that way. And if that is changing, then probably you should not have been buying that expensive item as well. Maybe go from like a more expensive thing to like a less expensive thing. Yeah. So I think that is what it is. It is very much at the margins. So say you are borrowing, maybe you say I defer. So either you'll say, okay, it's getting more expensive for me to borrow, so I defer it by a few months. Maybe I buy something cheaper, so I borrow a smaller amount, right? So that is what it's going to affect things at the margin on an aggregate level. But all said and done, if like this changes your decision for like these lot of these consumer loans are very small unsecured loans. Some of them are for renovation of a house, right? So you buy a house, you can get a housing loan, which is secured by the house, but unsecured loan is for home renovation. So then you say, okay, maybe I save a bit on these costs. Maybe I borrow a little bit less. So I think those things are there. That's about it. Or if the interest expense over here goes higher, that much money I spend less in eating in restaurants. Or so some it'll affect somewhere, but only at the margin. And the Indian economy is going all fine. So I think this is just being smart about things. That's all.
All right. Before we wind up, a few other news items that we thought we'd cover in a jiffy. Subroto Roy, the founder of Sahara India Group, passed away on Tuesday due to a cardiorespiratory arrest. I don't know if a lot of you remember, about 15 or 20 years back, he was very much in the news, quite infamous as well. In 2011, in fact, the capital markets regulator SEBI had ordered two Sahara Group firms to refund the money raised from nearly 3 crore investors through certain bonds known as optionally fully convertible bonds. There's a fantastic documentary on his life on Netflix, right? And, you know, if you want to understand how pre-financialization India was, I think, you know, this is a fantastic case study to that degree. Do check that out. Also, we have elections ongoing in Chhattisgarh and MP. Voting for 230 assembly constituencies in Madhya Pradesh and 70 out of 90 assembly constituencies in Chhattisgarh was held on Friday last week. So we'll bring you some of the updates on that. The counting of votes will take place on December 3rd for both these states. And also, as of this morning, Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, has been fired by the board. You know, there was some spiel of lack of confidence in his abilities or something to that effect. OpenAI has been in the news for ChatGPT. You know, the company has been valued at, I think, $90 billion at last I checked. And yeah, it's a bit of a shocking news, I would say, because Sam was at the forefront of this. So the news is still unraveling, I would say. I mean, we'll get to know in the next few days why that was the case. Microsoft shares tanked about 2% based on this news, because Microsoft obviously is a key investor in OpenAI. Well, all right, with that, we come to the end of this weekly. If you made it this far, don't forget to rate and review this episode and the channel. It really helps us take this content to a wider base of people. And from Abhishek, Nero and myself, thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week. Do stay safe, take care, and Jai Hind.